Succession, number 28704, Real One.
Jim Harris, Real One. When and where were you born?
I was born in Scotland, in a town of Kilmarnock in particular. It's a town with a population of about 40,000 and approximately about 30 miles from Glasgow. It had a few industries there that became quite well known. For example, Glenfield and Kennedy were hydraulic engineers, and they boasted that they were engineers to the Empire. The Empire was very much involved then. Mm. And of course, Saxo and Shoes, again another worldwide organisation, I would think. Also, Johnny Walker Whiskey was associated with the town as well.
Did your father work in those industries?
Well, my father, who was unfortunately killed when I was a boy about four. No, he was a bank manager. He was employed in as a bank manager. Then also Blackwood and Morton, which is carpets, again, was... So all in all, for a small town, you know, had some fairly well-known industries on the doorstep.
Right.
I went to a school, local school, of course. I had, along with my sisters, I had two sisters. The family was my mother, as I say, alone, two sisters and myself. We attended a local school, and I left school at 14 years of age.
Did you enjoy your schooling?
Yes, I did, actually. Yes, I did. I quite enjoyed school.
What subjects did you like best?
English, history and geography. I think these were my best subjects. I've always had an interest in history in particular.
And were you good at sports?
Yes, I've always had... I played football like most boys did there, but apart from that, I played golf along with my mother. I think my mother was one of the few women that played golf in those days, and I was the caddy officially, and we had a few rounds of golf together until such times as, unfortunately, she fell and twisted her knee, and that rather ruled her out. But I carried on from that, and as a boy I played quite a bit of golf.
Do you think you missed out your father died?
Yes,
at an
I
early
did.
Age.
Yes, I did very much so. Mm. On reflection, yes, I did so. Yeah, I think so. I think it, particularly with schooling was limited for me. I mean, under normal circumstances, I think I would have gone on to a more higher education, but because of our family circumstances, I think the schooling was cut short, and there was a question of, you know, really finding some work to do and virtually helping out with the family budget. And that also applied to my sisters as well.
Were they older or younger?
Yes, they were older than me. They were 2 years older than me, mm-hmm. About 2.5 years older than me. Yeah, I think it did have a big impact, and I've always felt, yes, you know, things might have been different, mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, you can't dwell on them. But yes, I do believe that was a handicap.
And yes, because a bank manager would have quite a standing in the town, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, and we lived in a particularly good area there. And yes, I mean, that could have been a more comfortable existence, you know, had he not had his accident. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for example, he was one of the few people who had a car. And unfortunately, you know, during one of his journeys, he crashed on that and was killed as a result of the car accident. So it was a major blow, you know, for my mother. And I think it must have proved quite a strain for her, you know, bringing up three children. Especially in the, you know, those days, you know, pre-war, when there weren't so many benefits.
Did you have to go out to work? Or?
Yes, I went out to work at 14 years of age. I got my first job around about 14 years of age. And I worked for an engineering company, Glenfield and Kennedy, just as a boy. And then later on, I joined a firm of electrical engineers and became an apprentice electrician. And that was what I was before I joined RAF. I started my apprenticeship for that.
So during the 30s, did you take interest in the news articles about what was happening in Germany and the rise of Hitler?
I think we knew what was happening. We know we heard about this man Hitler, and but I don't think we were particularly well informed of the situation. I don't know why, maybe we didn't look for enough information. But I always remember when I went down to Troon, where my grandparents lived, playing with a boy down there, a boy about some of my own age. And his father had been in Germany on business, and he'd come back home, and his son told me, he said, my father is speaking about this man Hitler. He said he seems to be very important, you know, he seems to be something really, everything, you know, to the German people. So that was really the first indication that I had, really, you know, on a direct basis, that, you know, Hitler was really a power to be reckoned with, as one might say. But apart from that, I don't. I think, of course, the thing was building up. There was the Munich crisis and Chamberlain coming back, and things just seemed to really drift into a war situation. I don't know if it was actually expected, but we just seemed to very quickly go into a war situation.
So, I mean, when war was declared, how old were you?
1939, I would be around about between 16 and 17. And my sisters would be 2 years older than I was.
So what happened once, I mean, what did you think once war had been declared? Was it a sense of excitement or fear and dread?
I think it was something, excitement anyway. I don't think really... probably realised the full impact of it, you know, people going off to war and fighting. Although, what happened prior to that, I was, you know, we were a bunch of chums together, and I would be the youngest of that lot, along with my own particular pal. So what happened then, there was National Service of that coming out at that time, and people of a certain age were going to be called up for full-time service in the army. But there wasn't any other service. But there was an alternative, and that was, if you joined the territorials, you would have to go away. So I wasn't there at the time, but what happened was, they told me later that they'd been getting together, and there'd been some playing field. And they met this recruiting sergeant, and he sold them the proposition that if you join the territorials, you know, you won't have to go away from home, you see, you're only a kind of weekend soldier, you see. So quite a few of them, you know, said yes to that proposition, including the chap who was my own particular chum. So what really happened was that they joined the local territorial army. I think they had one camp out of it, you know, in the summertime. We always all went off to camp, but they had one camp out of it, and then when they came back home, and then within a few months, war was declared. And then, you know, just like that, you know, a snap of the fingers, all the people that I had been friendly with and chums with and running around, you know, they were hauled off into the army. I always remember, I mean, I was downtown one evening, and I was going to the cinema, and the drill hall was opposite the cinema. I was going into the cinema, and my chums were all across the road in the drill hall, you know, waiting to, you know, get posted to whatever unit they were in, actually. But they all went away, about six or seven of them, all in the Territorial Army, and that was that. And I never saw them again until about 1946.
Goodness.
After that, they went into various, you know, bits and pieces of the army.
So as a 16 or 17-year-old?
Well, he was by that time, he was just coming up. Yeah. He just must have just been on the edge,
yes.
You know, 17.
Yeah.
And he went in. Mm. The rest of the boys were all older by a couple of years or so,
yes.
So there was no problem there. But when I heard he had gone in, I thought, well, you must have just really been on the edge, you know, for recruitment.
So did you get called up as in the civil defence, the Home Guard unit?
Yeah, I joined the Home Guard. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I volunteered for the Home Guard.
Mm. What did that entail?
That entailed, you know, so many nights practice, and we were given uniform, and
did you start off with armbands only?
Yes, the old LDV armband, and not everybody had a rifle, of course. They were a bit on short supply. So we did exercises. Went out in the evening, and we took on other LDVs from a different branch, and and that, and we also had to do overnight stays in one of the local church halls. So I was into that for a short time as well, anyway, before I joined the Air Force.
Was your mother getting anxious?
My mother?
Hmm.
Yeah, because my mother was, I think, was quite cynical about the whole business, because she had lost her brother in the First World War, and I think that made her a bit cynical about the war, politicians, and the whole situation. See, as I said to my wife, he was killed when he was 19, which would be about the same age as I was when I joined the RAF. And the usual story, you know, a group of the boys all ran off and joined up. And anyway, he was in one of the Highland regiments, and he was killed. But they never spoke about it in the family after that. Not to me. It was just I think my mother only made one fleeting reference to him. The subject was never brought up. Nobody ever spoke about it. Never spoke about him. And I don't think I ever saw a photograph of him either. I don't think it was as if the situation was blotted out. And my grandfather never spoke about him. And grandmother, seemed odd at the time, but having watched the television recently, apparently that was a fairly normal reaction. The people just couldn't bring themselves to talk about the loss. So consequently, my mother was, I think she really worried about the war, and as I say, I'm sure she was cynical about politicians. And I think she was worried about the future, as far as I could see. Yeah.
Did you get much information from the radio or exactly what's going on in Dunkirk?
Yeah, well...
Or did you feel a long way away up in Scotland?
I don't think so. I think because they had a series of lectures every Sunday in one of the big cinemas in Kilmarnock, and people really packed in to that on Sunday evening, you know, and were told about the war. You would hear speeches, you know, Churchill's speeches, etc., etc. And I think there was a definite attempt to try and tell the people, you know, what was going on. Whether that was on a need-to-know basis, I'm not quite sure. Knowing about the services, I suspect it was. But I think that people were reasonably informed about it. But thinking about it, I always maybe with hindsight, I always felt as that, you know, you never knew. We were limited because we lived in Scotland. I had never been out of Scotland on holiday, even. Most people hadn't been. It was all very localised. And what I used to think was that, you don't really know the Germans individually. You know, no question about that. All it is that's Germany, you know, and, you know, they're the enemy. And you know, our knowledge of individual Germans, of course, was absolutely zero. And you know, I think that's always the thing about war. You know, you don't really know your enemy. You know, you know them as a country. And I can tell you when I first saw my Germans, but perhaps we can leave that to later. I'm not quite sure.
Yes, as we go on. Yes.
You know, when I say when I first saw them, when I actually saw Germans. These men, you know, they're, you know, that's our enemy. I mean, that came to me later when I was in the Air Force. But before that, no. I mean, we just. I think we rather accepted the situation as that. This is our country, right or wrong.
So as you got to more towards 18, what happened then? Did you get called up or?
No, I volunteered. More or less a throwback from the First World War, I would imagine. You know, I don't think I was working with some of the boys I was working with. You know, decided that we'd like to join up, and I'm not quite sure what our motive was, to be honest. I can't really spell it out. I think we just wanted to get into it.
What made you choose the RAF?
I think because the RAF had suddenly become well known. Probably more glamorous. I had the kind of more. I think that was one of the things of the war. I mean, the RAF seemed to be, you know, as opposed to the old army foot slogging, shall we say. Mm-hmm. The RAF seemed to be, and of course we were technicians anyway, as it were. so we decided that the IDF would be for us.
So what date was that that you joined at?
I think it's here somewhere now. The actual date in Edinburgh was 16/5/41. But prior to that, prior to that, we went up to Glasgow, and we went by bus. And as luck would have it, the chap who and one of the partners in the business happened to be passing the bus station, and he saw us standing there. I think he had jumped to the conclusion of what was happening. Because when we arrived back the next day, they called us in and said, "Right, tell me, you know, what's happened?" And we said, "Well, you know, well, we've been up at Glasgow, and you know, we've volunteered for the Air Force." So we went sworn in then. We were only sent back home, and then it says here 16/5/41. We were called through to Edinburgh. We had an interview, and then we were sworn in. And the vast majority of us were all really quite young. You know, we're around about my age.
So the Battle of Britain.
The Battle of Britain had gone by then.
September before, so you thought you ought to be one of the Death Glory really boys.
Well, the Battle of Britain had come and gone then, and but as I say, the Air Force had suddenly in the public eye, I think, had really had a very, very different image. Probably, as I say, quite honestly, I think it seemed a bit more glamorous, and the uniform was better, yes. You know, collar and tie, and. It seemed better than the army, you know, with no just the army uniform, I suppose. I think there must have been an element of that in it as well. And,
so how much longer after being sworn in was it before you actually got called up to your reception unit?
I think it says here that July 41. I was sworn in on the... I put in the reserve the 24th of the 6th, 41. And then down here I've got the School of Technical Training on... 25/7/41, but before that, of course, I was called up and went down to Padgate. Padgate was a reception centre. That could very well be 6WG here, as noted. Padgate was the reception centre. We were all gathered together, and we were sent off to Wimslow. Sorry, Wimslow, which is outside Manchester, and we did our foot slogging, well, you know, basic training.
So coming from a home full of girls, was this a bit of a shock to you?
Yeah, it was. All of a sudden they were, you were something totally different. I mean, you were taken away, you were given your uniform, you know, at Wimslow, and. We had no drill there at all, actually. We had drill at Wimbledon, but Padgate, no drill at all. What happened was we were in a uniform, and that was the first time we all marched off in uniform as a unit of the RAF.
Did you actually have a proper suit, or was it like denims that you had?
No, we had a proper uniform. Yeah, proper uniform. But at that stage, we marched off as a unit in the RAF, you know, feeling quite, you know, I suppose, pleased with ourselves, you know. Attracted quite a bit of interest, you know, marching up to the railway station, you know. You know, people were there, you were looking on, and it gave one a sort of boost. Anyway, when we got to Wimslow, which was our training base, they marched us into the camp, and we just kept on marching past the huts. And I thought, well, you know, where are we going here? So we got to the very tail end of the last of the huts, but we still kept marching on, and we marched into this big open field. And we could see the tents there, and this was our new home in the RAF. It was in tents, you know. This was something totally unexpected. I mean, I don't suppose any of us had really been under canvas at any stage before, but that was our existence there for our training days. Good warm summer it was, and there were about eight of us in a tent. And
did you manage to get in a tent with anybody you knew?
No, everybody was a complete stranger to me. I didn't know anybody at all, a complete stranger.
Were they a good group?
They're all about the same age, and anyway, we got packed into the tent. There were about eight in the tent. We closed the flaps and, you know, settled down for the night, you know, on just on the ground. It was basic, no beds. And we'd only been in there for about several minutes, and NCOs came round and come on, open up the flaps, get some fresh air in there. You know, you can't live and sleep like that. You know, you have to get some fresh air in. So we lived a pretty well open air life, you know, during the training. It was a good summer, I remember. And
where did you wash and clean yourself?
Well, the ablutions up at the, I mean, the communal ablutions, as they called it. And you just, you know, got up in the morning and you got across there and did your washing, shave and shower, whatever. And that was that. I mean, everything became communal. You know, that's the first thing, you know, individually, you're no longer an individual. Everything has to be shared. You know, your living quarters, your washing facilities, your toilet facilities. That's that. Your eating facilities, you know.
Got decent food?
Yeah, I don't recall anything really wrong with the food at all. No, I can't say that. I can admit that the food was bad. No, I think the food was... we ate it and survived.
How did you get on with your NCOs?
Yeah, very good. They were all they were all fairly new, I think, really NCOs. Yeah, I think the war had sort of brought in people very quickly promoted. The sergeant there was a bit of an old sweat, really, and he was constantly chiding his junior NCOs, you know, his men of little service, and his favourite expression to them was, "Come on, you lads, get your knees brown." That meant to, you know, get overseas and get some service there. And he was always ribbing them, you know, about this, you know, "Come on, get your knees brown." And, you know, it's, I suppose, helped to keep them in their place, as it were. But we'd, I quite enjoyed the training. Yeah, it was a good open air. And, you know, we had our football and...
Did you have to go? Do you have a lot of kit inspections?
And yeah, well, not too much of that time. We had medical inspections and we had inoculations and dental inspections, things like that. And even that was on a communal basis. I always remember the dentist, everybody lined up and you went in one by one. And I had to get a tooth out, for example. He took a tooth out from me. So what he did was, he gave me the injection and the gum and then sent me outside to wait while he looked at somebody else. And then when they knew that my injection had taken, you know, he took me back in and he pulled the tooth. You know, no tender loving care from mother.
What had your mother made of you joining up? Was she?
Well, I think she was apprehensive.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that it was the Air Force and ground staff, I think, really reconciled her to it.
Yeah. Did you write home or a lot?
Well, yeah. When I was here in the UK, I wrote some letters, but I have to be honest, there wasn't a great letter writer, you know.
Did you get any time off in the local town when you were...
Yeah, we had a few after... went out locally after, you know, an evening, but not a great deal. I think we're more or less tied to the, you know, camp, one thing or another.
Mm. Did you have to do guard duties?
We didn't have any guard duties as such at that stage. We didn't... I don't know whether we couldn't be trusted with a rifle or not, but no, we didn't have any guard duties as that. But that was your initial training, you know, discipline and drill, you know, left, right, and how to salute and what have you. And that was the preliminary course, you know, before going off to Henlow, you know, to go through the training school.
They took into consideration your qualifications as an electrical engineer.
Well, they did actually. When we were the very first interviews up at Edinburgh, you know, they asked us about our background, you know, what do we know, and one thing or another. But as they were sending us off to a training course anyway, I mean, I think they were quite happy if you were basically, you know, skilled, as it were. I think they were going to train you for what they wanted you to do, you know, working with the aircraft. And
so where did you go next after your training?
Well, after we did the basic training, we went off to Henlow, and we did our, I think it's got right down here, it's 14 School of Technical Training, and I completed that course. I'm not quite sure how long we were there. I'm not quite sure how, the date's here somewhere, I do believe. But I finished that, and...
And what did that entail,
the
technical training?
Well, that just entails you that you have achieved the lowest rank, AC2, and you're an electrician, and you're you know, you're capable of doing what we call the basic duties on an aircraft. To be an electrician, there were actually two groups, so there were a Group 2 and a Group 1. I mean, he would advance me from group two into group one, and I believe that it could have been that there were some people who were better qualified as electricians, you know, if they were sufficiently passed, they could perhaps move them straight on to group one, and that would have been a different school, you know, after the basic training, which meant something because you were automatically on the promotion trail then. No promotion in group two, I mean, they had to get into group one. Anyway, the long and short of it is I passed out onto group two, AC2, and I went to air crew training unit up at Silloth in the Solway Firth.
What date was that?
Well, I think that says the 12th, 41, actually. Yeah.
So you're back to Bonnie, Scotland?
Well, that's just over the border from Scotland. So I think there was a humane touch there, really. The RAF had, you know, had suddenly a humane touch.
Did you get a chance to go home and see Mother?
Yes, I did. I'd even leave when I was on the training school. We got a weekend pass to go back home. Well, we were down at Henlow, and that was quite an achievement, you know, because we did dash across country, pick up a mainline train going up to Scotland on Friday night, and then the early Sunday night, I should say, you're way back down again. But that was when I first realised that I was becoming institutionalised, shall we say, because my first impression was when I went home and leave, and you know, when I saw the small cups and saucers on the table, you know, decorations on the wall, you know, the tablecloth, you know, I realised that, you know, life had changed somewhat, and, you know, everything seemed so homely and civilised, if we could put it that way, whereas, you know, I'd been getting used to something totally different. Mm. But anyway, it was good to go home and leave. And,
did you have a girlfriend that you went to
see? No, I never had a girlfriend. Mm. I never had a girlfriend at all. I don't know why. I mean, I didn't seem to be getting involved in that situation at all, even any stage, you know, nothing permanent at all, really, no, I didn't bother. But anyway, then I went to Silloth, which was on the Solway Firth, and the nearest town to that is Carlisle. And that was a training unit for, I think it was for, I don't think it was for bombing, if I remember rightly. It was Coastal Command, I think. Coastal Command. The aircraft that were flying were Hudson's, and that was David probably right, because, well, it was right, because I remember at that time the Americans came into the war, you know, and
so that was the end of December 1941.
I always remember it was a particularly cold winter. I remember that for sure, and I had started off there living in the barracks. Usually, you know, 24 people as it were in the barracks. But later on, I applied and got billeted with in civilian digs. And
Did you prefer that?
Yes, I did. Mm. Oh, I did actually. I think so. In the barracks itself, there were, you know, people were moving in and out all hours of the day and sometimes night, you know, depending. So it wasn't, if you were living with somebody, say it's on the night shift, you know, they're coming in and you're going out. Mm. So living in the digs was very much preferred, you know, to being in the barrack room. There is one thing I should mention, that when I was on at training school, my mother came down to see me. And I think I was the only person whose mother came down to see him, you know. And I was